This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And that is students from the North End Music and Performing Arts Center Gala singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow at the center's 20th anniversary show last week. And accompanying them on the piano, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, a lifelong pianist. And it is Mondays with the Mayor today. So Michelle Wu, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Great to be with you.
So it's great to have you. We wanted to start there because when you were with us last, we asked you, hey, you've got a piano in your office. What have you been practicing? And you said that you were getting ready to accompany the kids. So how did it go?
It went fine. They are incredible. Even as you were playing that, I sort of winced a little. I had not performed publicly in about 15 years. So it had been quite a while and they kept me calm. We had actually missed out on all our rehearsal time as well because we had time scheduled earlier that day. But with the unfortunate building collapse over in South Boston, that was not possible. So we were sort of winging it and I followed their lead and they're incredible.
And do you think you will do more of that in the future? Is this the beginning of a new career in accompaniment?
It was in some ways having to practice in my office in the sort of couple days before was really quite relaxing and made me reconnect in a way that I hadn't in some time. But it was also quite a high pressure experience. So I may take a little break.
Take a little break from that now. You know, it is really striking to hear you talk. So, I mean, it was adorable, right? And that's fun. And that's part of being human. And it also really strikes me to hear you say, I was supposed to practice with these kids earlier in the day, right? But instead, there's a building collapse. It is a matter of life and death, not on your plan. You have to be there. That is your life now as mayor. And how do you move from one thing to the next like that? Stay whole and show up in the different spaces, the different ways you have to show up. How do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, some days it feels like in this role, and I would say this is true of so many people who are in public service and not just elected officials, but are city staff and neighborhood services liaisons and housing specialists. There's just so much happening in the world that sometimes by the end of the day, it feels like you've already experienced a week's worth of stress or effort or exhaustion. And for me, I'm pretty resilient. I can keep going. I kind of draw on the ability to connect with people as one of the greatest sources of meaning. And so when I'm able to be in different spaces, it's really about how can I try to connect or open up doors in that moment. And then at the end of the day, I'm quite tired, but we get back up the next morning.
I want to stay there because I noticed that you were at the Louis D. Brown Peace Institute's 26th annual Mother's Day Walk for Peace yesterday. And you're a mom. I'm sure you had Mother's Day plans of your own. And of course, that walk is really to show solidarity with moms who have lost their own children to violence in our community. And I wonder, who did you talk to? Who did you march with yesterday or walk with? And then when you go home and tell your own family as you prepare to celebrate your Mother's Day after that?
We've been part of that walk for many years. And so yesterday, several of us on stage were joking around that, in fact, the chilly wind was was totally fine because we've been there in downpours. We've been there in blistering heat. And it's important to show up because this is an organization that shows up for so many in our communities. These moms have experienced the unspeakable. And then to continue sharing their experience and reopening that trauma to be able to provide space for others to heal and for our community to heal is, I mean, there's nothing like a mother's strength and power. And so I think for our city, it's very, very special that we have Chaplain Clementina Sherry and this organization doing the work and setting the example for how cities across the country really think about providing supports for survivors and building community from a place of healing.
Did you go home and wrap your arms around your own kids after that?
Yeah, we had, we had a couple things in between, and also stopped by the Common for the Duckling Day parade. And there was a lot happening all around the city. So just a blessing to be part of it. And I feel so grateful to be able to also have my family part of the journey with me.
I want to move more into the policy space. You caused some other buzz over the last couple of days with your endorsement of Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo for Suffolk County DA. That's over interim DA Kevin Hayden. Hayden had his predecessor support Rachel Rollins as interim. Critics say Arroyo doesn't have enough experience. Why weigh in and why do that now?
I have worked with Councilor Arroyo in many different settings, public and private, on legislation, organizing, on programming and advocating for organizations that do this work, like those that we've already discussed. And, you know, I think many of the comments that we're hearing now are similar to those that we've heard for a long time when in Massachusetts and in Boston, we're trying to present a vision of change that can build community. And in this case, you know, his platform of really reducing crime while healing and providing the resources to build community is exactly what we need. And so the same statements of someone not being old enough or experienced enough, you know, and in some ways, I think that is code and signal for upholding the status quo. And it's clear that the residents of Boston in the mayor's race, in so many issue area campaigns and in other races, have said over and over again that it is time to get down to root causes, put out a clear vision, and follow through.
So code about his age, code about his race, code about it's reform-oriented versus traditional law enforcement-oriented. It's code for what?
Right, that this is a status quo that it hasn't been working for everyone. And so we want to see the types of reforms that former District Attorney Rollins had put into effect, which have been documented through research and data to bring about outcomes that in fact reduce crime and heal communities and stabilize and reduce recidivism. And so that is the approach, and that's the progress that we want to see keep going.
Okay, Mayor Wu, I do want to pepper in as we talk some of the questions that came through our texting platform for you. And I want listeners to know, if you want to become part of our texting group, which is a great way to ask your questions of our guests, you text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's the word Boston to 617-766-0382. So Kane Noon of Marblehead wrote, "I'm interested in response to recent acts of violence. I'm hesitant to go into the city for brunches, movies, other shows. I'm also interested in the recent construction accidents and the steps for future oversight." I want to stay in the first part of that. And for our listeners who may not know, there have been a group of children, the youngest reportedly 11, who are alleged to have caused several attacks or attacked numerous people in the city and areas around Boston Common, downtown Common, the McDonald's in Roxbury. You've taken a strong position of community support for the kids. So how do you address what Kay is writing in?
We know that safety has to be a baseline for everyone living in Boston, visiting Boston, getting to know our city, and that every single instance of violence or concern, public safety concern, is unacceptable. We also know that overall, Boston is in a different place than many other large cities, where in fact our statistics and the numbers around public safety have been quite low and remain quite low overall. And now again, that's not to say that to make any excuse for any individual instance. But I think sometimes there's an awareness of specific instances that sort of draw larger conclusions, but the data is very clear, and our trends are remaining quite low at this point in terms of the young people who have been the subject of many media stories, and in fact, whose identities never should have been leaked to the media, as they are minors, they are children. there have been services provided and there's been some accountability for adults in their lives. And agencies across the city, state, and county level have been coordinating very closely to make sure that we could wrap around and support there.
So I've seen some of that coordination in the past when I ran Catholic Charities. And as I saw it then, these were multiple agencies literally having conversations about families by name, saying, yes, what's going on in the family? What's going on with the parents? Are there siblings? So can you give us a little more eyes in to how you are providing what you have said you want to do with these wraparound supports for these kids? And does that include the two who have been arrested?
So multiple meetings have taken place, and this is not just about one particular incident or one particular group of young people, but it is the approach of our public safety and public health agencies to really get down to each meeting, each family where they are, and providing targeted resources, whether it's a connection point through the public schools or through a public safety agency or a community organization or a state level agency. And so there have been lots of conversations and meetings to go through what the plan is from each different touch point. And we are in this space now where there's been some accountability for actions that have been taken, but also support through the agencies that are closest.
And do you think that this has been, how much of this do you think has been due to COVID, to the destabilization of our kids through that pandemic?
I think a great deal of need has been deepened in our communities. And in every school that I visit, you hear from the school nurses that the wait list for mental health supports is longer than ever. They're scared that we can't get our young people treatment in the time that they need or in the type of response that they need. And so this is an investment that we are hoping to make at the city level to try to change the dynamic and really provide more resources. We're hoping to use a large chunk of our federal recovery funds to create a new behavioral health center based in the Boston Public Health Commission with a director of behavioral health, which would be a new first-time chief in that role, and to be able to work with all of our healthcare institutions in the area, specifically to recruit, support, and train mental health clinicians and providers of color and multilingual providers who can then be connected with job placements so we can start to fill this staffing shortage as well and make sure that our communities have the availability and access to mental health supports.
It is Mondays with the Mayor. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is with us answering our questions and yours. Mayor Wu, I will pick up another listener question from our texting community. You promised to separate the functions of planning and economic development into separate departments. When will this happen? That's from Anthony in Boston.
This is still very much the goal as we're putting together the vision for how planning, development, zoning, and all the community needs that we're experiencing now fit together. Our new chief of planning will start in just a couple weeks. Arthur Jemison, who brings experience at the former Boston Redevelopment Authority, as well as at in state government under Governor Patrick and in his most recent role at HUD. So a new set of focus areas will, in addition to this new chief of planning role, the director of organizational transformation will be focused on how we start to bring about the structural reforms as well to how we do business in Boston.
Do you have a time frame in mind once the new leader's in? You know, are you hoping to see some serious restructuring in 6 months, 12 months? You think it's going to take a couple years? How are you thinking about that?
Well, with the pieces that we can move immediately, we're moving immediately. One example is the urban renewal authority that the agency has, and we have put forward a proposal to begin sunsetting that authority and transitioning to a more accountable structure. The new chief of planning will also be serving in a role as chief of planning that will involve connecting with all of the planning staff across other agencies of the city as well, in the transportation department and other areas that are thinking about climate planning. And that salary will come from the city of Boston, and he will not receive an additional salary from the BPDA on top of that. And so as we begin to build out the team and shift the team, we're in some ways, I make the example, the analogy of rebuilding a bridge that needs fixing. And there's a couple of these projects across the city. So you can visualize it, where rather than take the whole thing down and sort of stop everything for an undetermined period of time, you build the new structure alongside, and then you start to transition over. So it will be a period of years as we look to update our zoning code citywide and put in place the planning structures, but you should be able to see and feel some impacts even immediately.
All right, Mayor Wu, I want to talk about the Mission Hill School. Last Thursday night, the Boston School Committee voted to permanently close it. And this follows a recommendation to do so by the superintendent, Brenda Caselius, and a report that found sexual and physical misconduct there, a culture that tolerated bullying. That dated back as far as 2014. You've expressed real dismay over this. What is your top priority in this moment to heal for families and take action based on what happened in the shutting down of a school?
The top priority is to ensure a supportive, healthy, positive transition for the students and educators who are at the school. We are working
about 200 students.
We're working family by family to make sure that, for example, the school district has reserved seats in some of the schools in the immediate vicinity and are working very closely to support those transitions. There were no good choices here. This is a situation from years ago that continued to have ripple effects. And because the accountability and action was so delayed from years ago, we were left with very difficult choices. But ultimately, the decision to move on and support the transition, both for the young people and for educators, including incredible teachers who I've had the chance to speak with and hear from. They have been pouring their everything into trying to heal this community. And again, because of decisions delayed from years ago, this was simply not possible and was not set up for it to be possible. So we're looking to make sure that we all can reconnect and heal.
So this is in the last 8 years, so it is fresh for some. I mean, it lives in today, even though, as you say, it's looking back a number of years now. I got to assume your posture is never again. What is the first step in never again now?
This is a clear call that every single school, every single classroom needs to be a place where our young people are not only safe, but supported. And if there are incidents that arise, there cannot be an excuse or a culture or feeling that it will affect the school's numbers the wrong way if something gets reported. Or, it's just, we need to always have as our leading light the health and safety and well-being of our young people. And I know that is what all of our school leaders are working towards. And we look to make sure, as we're transitioning leadership of the district as well, that this is deeply ingrained in how we are setting the visions and goals and pathway forward.
All right, let's do a couple lightning round questions. They're always fun. Are you ready?
Ready.
Okay, so schizophrenic weather, right? Sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's warm. The big question is, do you switch at some point from hot to iced in your coffee or tea? And have you done it yet?
So I'm not a coffee drinker. I do drink tea. I'll usually go matcha latte. But I actually, it's not for me, it's not a seasonal switch. It's whatever the day is. So I'm happy. If it's summer and somehow it's freezing cold, I will happily take a hot matcha latte and vice versa.
And where's your favorite place to get one? Or do you make it at home?
There's been a couple places. So Pavement has a great one. There's a bunch of coffee shops in and around the Government Center area. I just was at Finista over the weekend, where there's been a unionizing push as well. And so I like to hop around and not picky. So it's my go-to.
All right. I want to talk about those warm summers now for just a minute. You focus on climate resiliency. You've come out with a heat plan. It does a number of things short term, for example, pop-up cooling kits for public city events or nonprofit organizations, a grant program for property owners on cool roofs. What is the sort of imperative this summer as you start to lay down your heat plan and change the way the city is supporting, especially environmental justice communities in extreme heat?
The plan is really about addressing the fact that even though we know what to do in the big picture, that many of these changes will take time and the need is here right now. And so as we're looking to grow our urban tree canopy and make sure there's green everywhere, which helps take the temperature down, or that buildings are resilient and our energy codes are hit the right standards, there are, you know, just in a couple weeks or even next week, there's going to be a pretty warm day and it will go up from there. And just a couple weeks from now, our young people are in school buildings that often don't have HVAC systems that are modern. And so we need to be responsive to the urgent needs as well. And in some ways, what Boston had been doing for a while wasn't necessarily serving communities or seeing the uptake, right? The traditional strategy had been we open up cooling centers, and they're located either at a community center or other spaces. But even on very high heat days, very hot days, we were not seeing a lot of seniors or other residents coming in to spend the day there. And so we're trying to be responsive and look at what both the urgent timeframes are, but also how best to match what will actually work for people in Boston.
Let's talk about another group of vulnerable residents, which is the people who have been congregating in theory around Massachusetts Avenue and Mount Nyakass Boulevard, where there's been a real intersection of homelessness, mental health, and addiction. In December, the city opened an engagement center there. Last week, reporter Deb Becker was on air talking about how the center had closed for a few days after a series of stabbings in the area. She's now gotten word from those providing aid that the center will be closed for 2 weeks. Is that the case, and why the extension of the period of time that it's closed?
The winter push to make sure that as many of the long-term residents of the former encampments were connected to housing was urgent, and it was about addressing a humanitarian crisis of people living in tents with no heat or hot water in very dangerous conditions. While we continue to see great progress from that push and have currently, I think about 180 residents, former residents of the encampments, are now in low-threshold supportive housing, accessing treatment and care, and a number of whom have already moved from this low threshold transitional housing into permanent housing in other parts of the state. We continue to see with the warming weather, large crowds gathering, and that has been difficult for public safety. It's been difficult because there are other issues that are connected to crowds. There's been some very troubling
So is it not safe?
Drug trafficking.
Not safe to have the center open?
The staff at the center and at the Boston Public Health Commission are working to provide resources and programming so that we can increase access across the city and not have everything concentrated in one place. And so in the immediate term, for the health and well-being and safety of everyone involved, the decision was made to create some space, but we look to expand access to those services and make sure that there's not only housing, but the ability for transportation access with the shuttle system that we've set up to connect people to services throughout the day, and also for treatment and the engagement center and the services provided there to be available in other parts of the city and start to decentralize some of this.
So am I hearing you say, and I'm sorry, we have to do this very quickly, but am I hearing you say that the engagement center may not reopen in its current form?
I'm not saying that. I believe that we are looking to add spots in different parts around the city or to coordinate with service providers who are already up and running in different parts in the city and to get transportation more closely coordinated. But we're working very quickly on that and want to make sure that in all parts of the city that there's safety and that we can begin to expand the access and decentralize.
Okay, that is Boston Mayor Michelle Wu with Mondays with the Mayor. Mayor Wu, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again next month. Boston restaurateur and culinary superstar Tiffany Faison made history last month. She won season 3 of the Food Network's Tournament of Champions and the biggest Food Network prize ever. Now, if you have tasted her food before, that may not be shocking. In fact, here is how Faison herself and hosts Guy Fieri and Simon Majumdar described a cauliflower sauce in the competition that she needed to be very velvety.
You know what that is? Velvety.
I know.
Gangster.
I think if I ever leave my wife, it'll be for that cauliflower sauce.
So we caught up with Faison while she was, get this, in Louisville, Kentucky, cooking for the Kentucky Derby. And we talked about her numerous second place finishes, what it meant to finally win, as well as Boston's reputation within the culinary community and what the future of the city's food scene could and should look like. But we did start by reliving that moment when she was announced as the winner of the Tournament of Champions.
Ladies and gentlemen, fans of TOC3, the winner of the Tournament of Champions between B-Dub, Chef Brooke Williamson, and Sweet Tea, Chef Tiffany Faison, is...
So take us there. So there's this moment, right? They flash your name up on the big screen. Guy Fieri says your name. Which came first? Did you see it on the screen first or did you hear it? How did it sink in?
I honestly don't know. First of all, it never gets old. I every time I hear it, I'm like, oh, this is really, like, I have a moment where I was like, who wins? It's me. I don't know. I've honestly, it's such a blur. Like, I definitely remember standing there. I remember thinking, I just don't want to come in second again. I remember just really like preparing myself to not win. And then it was just, I think I saw my name up. And then I remember Guy saying Tiffany Faison wins, kind of around this. It was surreal. I don't know. Blur.
So
best blur ever.
You were pretty real on the show and said, you just said this, and I'm going to play you a little more sound of you saying it on the show too. You know, I've done a lot of seconds, so here you are.
There's so much about coming in second in my career, and I'm grateful for all the opportunities that I've gotten, but there's just this, I've had this inability to, like, break through, like, a really big battle, like, a really big competition, a really big win, and I want this.
So you've said it never gets old. You've had a few weeks to sit with it now. Does it mean to you as much as you thought it was going to mean to you?
Yes, it does. You know, it's interesting because I think in some ways these are so giant, the moments, you know, competition like this. And then, you know, I get perspective and I'm like, it's a game show and it's, you know, but it really is, as much as both of those things, it's the culmination of all the work that I've put into my career. Like, you don't just show up on a show like this and succeed without really doing the work. So, you know, when I have moments where I'm like, well, girl, relax, it's not that big of a deal, I bring myself back to like, yeah, actually it is a big deal and it's okay to celebrate yourself. So, it does mean as much as I thought it would. Yeah.
It's a game show, but it's also a skill show. And,
yes.
You know, at the end, you're holding this big belt. It looks like you've just come out of a heavyweight title.
And you, 'cause I have.
Yeah. And you're knocking on it and you're like, this is mine, baby. Did it change your sense of how good you are to win? Or did it just validate what you already knew about how good you were?
Wow, that's a question that I can't answer well either way. I don't think I have a sense of like, oh my God, I'm so good at this. I don't feel that way. I feel like I can have a great day, have a tough day. And that's one of the really interesting things about TOC. Everyone there can win and everyone there is beatable. So it's just really about putting 5 great days together.
With some really, really hard requirements. So listeners may not know, you get this sort of random assignment of food ingredients and ways you have to prepare it and equipment you have to use. And you got some really gnarly stuff in the final, including like this anti-griddle, which freezes things instead of cooking them. Was there a moment where you thought, I don't even know how to put my brain around. I mean, you had 60 minutes to figure out how to do this.
Yeah, and cook it all. You have to, that's the fear, right, is that whatever this is, like whether it's TOC or Chopped, or when the challenge is put in front of you, the fear for me is that my head will just go blank. It hasn't happened yet. I hope to God it doesn't. No, you just work through it. I didn't know how I was going to use the anti-griddle. I knew kind of what I would do with the rabbit. I was able to kind of work through the natto as I continued to cook. But the anti-griddle was a little bit of like a giant, it was a giant question mark. And then as I sort of started cooking through my dish, I figured out, okay, you can make the chilies like less. I can, you know, essentially take some of the heat out of the chilies by freezing them. And I can reverse caramelize my rabbit. I can do things with this anti-griddle. The truth is we've had an anti-griddle on Chopped for years and we finally threw it away
because no one could use it. So just for listeners, natto is this kind of fermented soybean concoction. And you were talking about chilies because you made a crepao that, and you used the anti-griddle to get some of the bite out of that. Yeah, so here's this other thing, and we will talk about some other things, but this was fascinating to watch you go through this journey because you did kind of go back and forth between brash confidence and I'm not going to make this. So I want to set this one up. It's the morning of the final. You meet your competitor, Brooke, outside. It looks like you guys are outside your trailers. Mm-hmm. You're hugging each other. And while you're hugging her, you have this exchange.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Ready to go down?
Ready to go. Good luck to you.
Down. I said go down.
No.
So was that bravado? Was that trash talk? Or were you really two Tiffanys, the one that sometimes thought you were going to win this and the one that sometimes was in your own head?
Yeah, I think we're all multiple people within the same person. It's all of that, right? It's trash talk. I love Brooke. We've been friends for years. I also wanted to get in her head a little bit. You know, like she wins everything. The woman just sails through. She's an assassin. She just sails through things and like wins. So there was a part of me that, yeah, wanted to get in her head a little bit, but also, you know, just having fun and poking. And no part of me is like, yeah, Brooke, I'm going to take you down so hard. Like I did. No, I didn't think that at all. It's more me trying to get in her head and just having some fun.
Well, and her laughter did kind of suggest that she knew the space that the two of you were in. I do want to back up. You know, she's won a lot of stuff. You've competed in a lot of stuff in the Food Network. Top Chef contestant in the first season back in 2006. You came in second there. You were painted as a bit of villain on the show. There's been, I mean, that has been talked about ad infinitum, right, for the last 16 years. Looking at it now, though, looking back, I do want to ask you, given what we know now about how women are treated, how women in the culinary world are treated, do you think you were set up as a trope? And do you think you'd be set up the same way if it were now?
That's a great question that no one's ever asked me. I do think I was set up in some ways. I also let myself play right into it. I accept responsibility for as harsh as I was around a lot of things. I was also young and insecure and not making excuses. I played right into it. As you said, understand women differently now, not as well as we should, but we understand women a little bit differently now. We understand chefs differently now. So do I think it would have been the same now? No. I also think Top Chef has never really come to terms with how they treated women for a long time. They've never really had a moment and talked about it. They've changed how they portray, how they edit. But they've never, it bothers me a little bit that there's never been a moment of like, hey, we got this wrong.
So you were the woman people love to hate. We fast forward to 2022. Boston loves you. And I want to talk about that a little bit. We aren't necessarily known as a culinary capital here in Boston.
We're getting there. We're getting there.
Do you feel like you won this for Boston at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Boston's been my home for the better part of 20 years. I started cooking here. And so there is a part of me, the weight of not just winning this for me, winning it for my team, winning it for my city, bringing this home. Yes, absolutely. Like we, I've been so blessed to have developed a relationship with the city and the people of Boston. And, you know, Boston can be tough. And when I tell you, I've been entirely embraced and loved by the city, and I feel it every day. And I'm so grateful for it. So yeah, this is also so much for Boston.
So I would take from that then that if I asked you, do you think you won because you were lifted up from here or in spite of the fact that you were here? Sounds like you'd say you felt lifted up.
Lifted up, absolutely. There is no in spite of being from Boston. Anyone who feels that way misses the city and gets us wrong. Lifted up for sure.
And who's lifted you up the most?
Oh, wow. My family, my friends. I know that's sort of my team lifts me up every damn day. They hold it down and allow me to come do things like this and to have a life that, you know, brings a lot to our businesses and brings attention to our businesses, but also they allow me to have a life that that lights us all up. And I never take that for granted. So first and foremost, my team.
So you have more than a half dozen restaurants. How long were you away? How long did that many people have to keep everything going here while you were gone?
2 weeks. So it shoots faster than it looks. The beginning of it is when there's 32 people, you get through the first round, and then essentially I had nearly a week off. People who don't win go home, and then you come back and the pace picks up a little bit when you get to the end, it's like cook, cook, cook. Like it's an adrenaline high and then a dump and a high and then a dump. So it's 2 weeks.
Did you nap for like 2 days? Afterwards.
It's so funny. I had a friend of mine that was sort of coaching me through it. I mean, the most bizarre things happen to your body that you really get in a space where you're like, please don't leave me. Like, don't pass out. Don't crumble. The morning of the finale, I was so cold, I couldn't get warm. Mm. And I remember speaking to her, and she's a therapist, and she's like, well, your body thinks it's going to die. Start there. You're not going to die. Back up. So, after it, I spent some time with Guy and some friends, and then the next 2 days I was dead. Just complete. I mean, high, but dead.
Guy Fieri being the host of the show. All right, let's come back to Boston here. How would you describe the food scene here in Boston today?
Well, I think it's tough now. I think we've had everyone's had a couple of devastating years. So, and what those years have meant to chefs and restaurants and how they've culminated in what we're doing now, I think has been really tough for a lot of us. Our menus are smaller because we have less staff and things are harder to execute. And so there's challenges that we're dealing with post-pandemic that I don't think are fair to the description of the city as a culinary bastion, because I do think we are. And, I think we're ever evolving. I think we are steadfast and strong and stubborn in some ways. We're really good at sprinting and then taking a second and kind of slowing down and looking around and reevaluating. I think we're sometimes self-conscious food-wise. We are, at our core, I think we play to and play for the people that live here. And so when we have audiences that let us run and jump, we can. And sometimes that shows up and sometimes it's harder. So ever evolving.
And are we at a level of sort of diversity and quality of options and talent here that we weren't at the beginning of your career, or are we just more aware of it now?
We are not as far as we should be. Look, there's not enough people of color cooking in our city with marquee, restaurant names that are recognized, and we should be. We're a city that is built on the talent and backs of women, and I would still say there's not enough women. I think sometimes we get in a clique of things that work, and we grind that down a little harder than we should instead of really pushing boundaries. I would love to see more ethnically diverse food. I would love to see more people of color really pushing the boundaries and celebrated in the city. That is still to come. I think that's still happening, but we're slower to start than we should be. So yes, both, right? Like, we're more aware of ourselves, but also we are still, we are pushing more than we ever have.
So let me give you an invitation to give a couple of shout outs. Is there a chef of color out there who's producing food that you just are a huge fan of?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a few. Seiji Amora at Cafe Sushi, I think, is one of the best chefs in the city. I just think he is the bee's knees. It's some of the best sushi in the country. They're not seating in the dining room right now, but they're doing takeout, and it's worth it. It's worth all your money and your time. So he's one of my favorites. I think about Douglas Williams at Mita is killing the game. Like, he's been, and I think been recognized nationally. He was nominated for Best Chef on the long list for the Beard Awards. So there are definitely people out there that we're starting to recognize and see, but more.
And
more
a woman?
Spaces,
give
more
us
time.
A woman too.
I would say, I mean, Cassie Puima is amazing. She runs Sarma. Everyone knows how good she is. I don't know why she is not winning a James Beard Award this year. She was not on the list, and I can't for the life of me figure out why. I'd like to burn it all down. When I did not see her name on the list, I wanted to burn it all down.
What do you think comes next for culinary innovation here?
I don't think right now is about culinary innovation. I think right now is about recognizing the things in our industry that need to change and can and should. And taking this moment as, it's never going to be a panacea, but taking a moment to fix some of the things that are really broken. I think it's a lot about holding it together right now and just trying to operate. There are multiple layers of what has happened in the past years that we're dealing with. And I think I speak for my company, but also probably for a lot of other restaurants out there, when we have been living in the, like, if we can just get through this, if we can just get through this next, if we can just make it through the next, and we are tired. We're all living there. Or if we can just get through the next, get, you know, hire this next person or make it to the, it's, I don't think anyone's like in a world in restaurants right now where we're lamenting how much fun we're having. So I think right now it's just about rebuilding and holding on and getting through this,
you know,
whatever this manifests to.
I want to pick up on that idea of being tired. And I'm actually going to go back to some sound from Tournament of Champions where you talk about what you've weathered and you talk pretty openly about it. Here it is.
Personally, it's been a really, really rough couple of years. I was married for 8 years. I had a divorce. I just turned around and, like, my life was gone. And my life was my restaurants and my wife, and that was gone. Just felt like everything in my life changed without my consent. And now the divorce is done. It's freed me up to be here again and to feel good about myself and to, like, be in an arena that I love being in.
I think many people would yeah, are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think many people would respond, you know, at a gut level to that idea that in the last couple of years, our lives changed in ways nobody signed up for.
Yeah.
What was the hardest part of that for you, and where did you draw your strength from to weather it while it was weathering you?
While it was weathering me is a great way to say it. My marriage started to fall apart at the end of 2019, and I remember all of us sitting around one of my restaurants and saying, well, it can't get worse. Never say that out loud. And it just went from that to COVID to what the hell is happening? Like, how does everything just fall through your fingers? And that was, I think, the culmination of it, of just, like, I felt I couldn't run myself out of it, and I couldn't, and usually I can find an angle or a way through or a fix. And that's my job as someone that owns a company. And I couldn't, I couldn't fix the fact that I had been left for someone that worked in our company in front of everyone. I couldn't fix the fact that there was a pandemic and we were closing restaurants and couldn't safely serve our guests. There was nothing I could fix. So I think for me, there was a lot of lessons that I learned in the powerlessness that I faced about what it means and how restorative it can be to sit in the not knowing and to sit in the not doing and get comfortable with things that are extraordinarily difficult.
But you didn't curl up. Some people would have just curled up. Where did that strength?
I didn't have an option.
There it is.
Like, what's the option? That I just, what, like, leave my life on the side of the road?
Yeah.
There's never been a, like, give up option in my life ever. I don't know where it comes from. I you know, came from a mom who doesn't give up. And what happens when I give up? What happens? everything that I've worked for just what falls to the side. I'm going to go get a job making sandwiches somewhere. Like I don't, it's just never been an option.
All right, let's go to a happy place, which
let's
is
do that.
Louisville, Kentucky, where we're pre-taping yes. this conversation with you because you couldn't join us in studio because you're cooking at the Derby. Is that like eh for you or really cool?
No, so cool. So cool. This is actually my eighth year. We do the Taste of the Derby, which supports Dare to Care, which is an organization that feeds people here in Kentucky. And today is the Oaks. It's all about celebrating women that have been survivors of breast and ovarian cancer. When I tell you it is, we haven't been here for a couple of years for obvious reasons. It feels so celebratory, and the energy is just extraordinary. It is never lost on me. I know that this is just one of those moments and events that is part of the American lexicon. It is a bucket list moment. I'm grateful to be here every time.
What are you cooking?
Last night we did the Taste of the Derby, and I did a Gulf shrimp, sort of spicy olive vodka fra diavola sauce with an olive oil fried crostini.
All right. So you closed Tiger Mama last fall. For folks who may not have been familiar with mm-hmm. it, Eater Boston called it your love letter to Southeast Asian cuisines. You did it mm-hmm. to open another restaurant in its place. You haven't told anybody yet what's taking its place. Do you want to tell us?
Not yet.
Oh, when will we know?
It'll happen this summer. So you will know, I would say within a month or so, people will know.
All right. And any future plans involving the Food Network?
Yes, actually, I just finished shooting a show called Beachside Brawl with Brooke and Antonia, and so that'll come out this summer. A bunch of Guy's Grocery Games in the can that you'll see, shooting Ranch next week, Guy's Ranch Kitchen, Always Chopped. There's lots of stuff out there.
So all right.
My bosses at the Food Network are keeping me busy.
And the most exciting thing for you on your docket for the next 6 months?
Just being able to live life a little freer. I don't know that there's one thing singularly that, there's a lot of stuff on my docket for the next 6 months. At some point I go to P-Town for, 4th of July every year for a week, and I take that week off. My brother comes and hangs out with me. I look forward to that week every year. So I am looking forward to a little bit of downtime.
All right. And that is Boston restaurateur and winner of season 3 of Tournament of Champions on the Food Network, Tiffany Faison. Tiffany, thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you so much for having me.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Francisca Monahan and Sarah Leeson. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. So glad you tuned in today. How about you do it again tomorrow for more Radio Boston?